This is Fresh Air. It's 4.5 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And with me now is Richard Stoltzman, who is considered by many to be America's premier clarinet soloist. He's one of the few clarinetists to establish a solo career. In order to create a large and diverse repertoire to sustain his playing, he's had to transcribe works written for other instruments and is also commissioning works. In 1982, Stoltzman became the first clarinetist to be presented in recital at Carnegie Hall. Stoltzman's playing has been acclaimed by the music press and the popular press like Time and Newsweek. He records for RCA Red Seal. In 1983, Stoltzman won a Grammy Award for an album of Brahms concertos.
Brahms sonatas.
Yeah. Richard Stoltzman has performed with many of the world's leading symphonies and was a founding member of the chamber ensemble Tashi. Although primarily a classical musician, he also enjoys jazz and frequently works in a couple of jazz compositions into his recitals. After Thelonious Monk's death, he performed a concert of Monk compositions with bassist Eddie Gomez. Next year, he'll be doing some playing with Woody Herman and his big band, and he's actually commissioning a few works for a clarinet and big band. Richard Stoltzman is in Philadelphia to perform this evening with the Philly Pops. The concert begins at 8 o'clock at the Academy of Music. Richard Stoltzman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Why do you think there are so few clarinet soloists?
Well, there are many, many talented clarinetists. And the trouble is that when you go to a symphony concert, you only hear the kind of brief moments of glory for the clarinet in, say, a Brahms symphony or an overture or something. There are these moments when the composer is given the clarinet beautiful statements, and so we hear those fleeting moments and forget that actually the clarinet is perfectly capable of extending those moments into entire concerti. I guess a lot of people have always relegated the clarinet to, you know, well, my sister and my brother played it in high school, and I hated the sound when they were practicing. Or it's a Dixieland instrument that really doesn't belong on the concert stage. Or it's kind of a monochromatic sound, or something like that. I think people are very surprised when they do hear the clarinet in a legitimate concert hall situation, in a recital, playing a wide range of literature. They're so surprised. Most people come up to me after concerts and, well, I hope it's a compliment. They say, gee, I didn't know the clarinet could sound like that. And I think it's very true that we sometimes forget that there's so many voices that the clarinet can have.
Did you think that you were going to play in an orchestra? Was that what you had been striving to do when you got out of school and
well,
finished your studies?
Yeah, sure. When you go to school, if you have any aspirations to be a performing professional musician, you look around and see what's available. And I guess for a clarinetist, the role models would be the principal chairs of orchestras. That's the sort of the highest that you can aspire. Except for in the days of Benny Goodman, when there were the big bands, clarinetists could, I suppose, imagine that maybe someday he might have his own big band and take a band on the road and be. But mostly, clarinetists, you either think of teaching or you think of. And my teachers trained me to, rightfully so, to try for auditions in orchestras. But unfortunately, every time I auditioned for an orchestra, I never made it. One of my teachers said, You're not fitting in. You know, you've got to learn how to fit in. Your tone isn't, the conductors are not, you've got to learn, first of all, you've got to learn to play perfectly. And I was always making mistakes. You've got to play perfect and you have to play it the same way each time. Otherwise, you're not going to get the job. I mean, once you get in an orchestra, if you have any personality, of course, then you begin to expand your role with the other wind players and with the conductor. And there are many fine clarinetists who have developed a whole sort of mystique around them about their playing. But I just never could break down the doors there. So I kind of by default, you know, just ended up on the street, you know, playing kind of and doing what I'm doing here.
Do you have any memories that still haunt you from the days you were auditioning for orchestras?
Well, I was always amazed at how many clarinetists there were for one job. And even back when I was auditioning for orchestras, I think it's even more acute now, but going to a hotel room and sort of being in a holding pattern with 45 or other 50 other clarinetists in the same room, all practicing the same excerpts from the literature and playing them twice as fast as I could play them. And I just scared out of my wits. And I think that's one of my memories. And then also auditioning for really, say, great clarinet players in orchestras and you know, asking their opinion and getting sort of feedback like, well, maybe you should consider engineering or something, you know. I just, yeah, I had some very sad memories about that.
Looking at it now, what do you think the differences are between the life of a clarinetist in an orchestra and the life of a solo clarinetist like yourself who travels around the world a lot and is, you know, has the independence but not the security?
Yeah, well, I think the security is one of the big pluses of being in an orchestra. And I've talked with some clarinetists who perhaps they, as from a distance anyway, they see what I'm doing as a very romantic or something that is, you know, the grass is greener kind of thing. But there is a kind of sadness in traveling by yourself all the time, especially if you have a family. I have a wonderful wife, Lucy, and two great kids, Margaret Ann and Peter John, and I don't see them very often. And there's this feeling that when you're traveling to all these wonderfully exotic places that people always say, oh my gosh, you're going to go to Australia. Don't forget to go to New Zealand and see the wonderful rainforest of something or other. Oh, you're going to Japan. We got to get to the temples here. Oh, you're going to France. Well, be sure and go to this cathedral. You know, basically, I go to the airports and get in a cab and get to the hotel and try to get my time balances back on the whatever time zone I'm on and see if I can find something safe to eat and practice and find out what reeds are going to work and then get to the hall. And that's about my whole object. I really isolate myself from the perhaps what you would say is the excitement of travel and the excitement of new places and concentrate just on my own individual performances.
Can you take more liberties with your tone and your vibrato if you're playing
well,
as a soloist?
That's a big plus, too. If you're in an orchestra and the conductor says, hey, softer, you know, or cut the vibrato or play faster, you do it. I mean, unless you just want to say, well, go blow and I'll walk out. But as the soloist, of course, you're exempt from that to a certain degree. I mean, we do talk over with the conductors various ideas and tempos and ways of playing, of course. But in the final analysis, when you get on the stage, you just do it the way you want to, the way you feel it. And that's a great freedom, which I would never give up. I think it's a fantastic luxury way.
Was there an ideal tone that you were taught when you were at
yes.
Yale or,
mm-hmm.
or studying in the
Yeah,
family?
There was an official clarinet tone, sort of an orthodox sound that is it can be described in words by various teachers, but it's usually spoken of as a kind of a core-centered pure tone with no vibrato and a kind of intensity that will cut through the strings and go out to the balconies of the various halls that you're going to be playing in if you're a symphony clarinetist. And I strived for that. I did try for that kind of quality of tone. But I found it as I began playing with less and less with orchestras and more sort of in front of them and less with wind players and more with string players, especially with like the Tashi group where we traveled so much just with strings, the kind of expectations about the music required that my orthodox or legitimate or whatever you want to call it tone needed some bending, some inventiveness in it to help express the music and also to work with the string players. If you're playing a quintet, like a Mozart quintet, you don't want to have the one voice out of five voices that's sticking out. You want to be part of a total sound that Mozart created, which was a quintet sound, not a clarinet soloist with a string backup. And that kind of quality of tone needs to be it has to be sympathetic to the qualities of string playing.
Why is a vibrato in clarinet scorned in classical music?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure. I think possibly, getting back to what we were speaking of earlier, that because of the clarinet's background in Dixieland and jazz, people teaching the clarinet perhaps thought, now, okay, we want people to consider the clarinet as a highly respectable and, you know, dignified instrument, and one way we can sort of prove that is to get this sort of vibrato, which is associated perhaps with a kind of less disciplined style or something, get it out of the playing. I'm just hypothesizing because I'm not sure that that's the case. But for all intents and purposes, most classical training is with that theory in mind, that the clarinet tone is a vibrato-less tone.
I'm speaking with clarinetist Richard Stalzman. When you decided that, okay, it looks like I'm not going to end up in an orchestra, I think I'll embark on a career as a soloist.
Well, I didn't say that.
You didn't say that?
Well, I didn't say, I think I'll embark on a career as a soloist. I just said, gee, I think I'll try to find a job. And I ended up at one of my former teachers, Mel Powell, who actually, as it turns out, happened to be Benny Goodman's pianist, but he was the professor of theory at Yale in composition. And he was the founding director in the music school of the California Institute of the Arts, which Walt Disney built in Los Angeles. So he called me in New York and said, hey, I'm going to start the school, and how would you like to be the clarinet teacher there? Then I said, great. So I left New York and all of its frustrations and disappointments, and went out to Valencia, which is near L.A., and spent four sort of beautiful years in the sun and in the environment of a very kind of radical but exciting art center at the California Institute of the Arts. But I still didn't really embark upon a career. It kind of came gradually.
Did you ever feel like you had to have a gimmick to stand out from all the other clarinetists?
Well, I didn't have to worry about that. I always was standing out from the other clarinetists or in the cold. No, I never thought about gimmicks at all. Not at all. The only gimmick I would say I tried for was to try to make the music the foremost in my playing, and if that meant that I had to do something different with the sound, then I would go ahead and do it.
I know I first became aware of your playing through the chamber ensemble Tashi.
Oh yeah, well that was one of my sort of openings to that. What would you call the embarking on the career thing? Yeah.
How did that ensemble get formed?
Well, Peter Serkin wanted to play the Messiaen Quartet for the End of Time, which is an instrumentation that includes a clarinet plus violin and cello and piano. And he was a great admirer of Messiaen's music. He hung around Marlborough, Vermont, where his father has a music festival. And I've been playing there for about 10 years. And one of those years, he asked me if I would like to come to New York and read through the quartet. I said, great. And he has a good friend, Fred Sherry, is a cellist. And then he also met Ida Kavafian, who was a young violinist. And we four got together at Fred's apartment and began exploring this piece, which a quartet for the End of Time is about an hour long. So it's kind of a big thing to undertake. And we were exploring that music. And then we found some other literature that was kind of fascinating to work with. And then Peter came up with the idea of giving a concert in New York, which just as a lark, a one-time thing, and it caught on, and it was packed with people, even though we hadn't advertised it much. And it sort of was from there on, we began playing more and more concerts until we had a kind of a I guess, a career as a quartet.
One of the interesting things about the ensemble was that you not only played Mozart and Beethoven, but you played new music.
Oh yeah,
as well.
Sure.
Do you think that you had a different attitude toward either performance style or the repertoire than most chamber ensembles did?
Well, I think one of the exciting things about Tosche, and still is about Tosche, is that we love to rework old pieces and rehearse them and challenge ourselves with them. And at the same time, we are very much excited by getting new works commissioned and playing new pieces and exploring them in the same kind of intense way that we would work on, say, Brahms or Mozart. With Peter, we commissioned Toru Takemitsu. Actually, we didn't commission him. He blessed us with a work and paid for all of the cost of it, and even brought us to Japan for the premiere of works by Toru Takemitsu. And then Charles Warren wrote works for us, and Tom McKinley, a composer in Boston, has written things for us, and Bill Douglas, a friend of mine from Canada, has written works for Tosche Group. This next year, we're going to be doing a commission that is from Lucas Foss, and he plays piano, so he's going to travel with the group as the pianist and play his work. You want to be on the sort of the cutting edge, the living edge of music, you know, as much as you do, of course, want to continue your relationship, your tradition with masters. You're all there is to music's future is you know, that getting new works inspired. I mean, getting them inspiring new works to be written, and that is basically one of the main reasons for a musician being alive.
To some audiences, I think, especially people who don't frequent classical music concerts, classical music has an air of being stuffy to them and therefore unapproachable. Have you tried to do anything other in your own recitals or in your work with Tosche that you think has tried to change that image in any way, or just undo some of the...
I know what you mean. I used to never go to concerts myself because I never thought I had any place in that environment. And it's a real uphill battle to get people off the streets where you know that they would love what's going on in the hall if you could just get them in there. And it's a problem. What we have done is, in many instances, is to do very, very simple things like just talk to the audience occasionally, not regiment our attire, make the programming very flexible so that we're always including music of today as well as yesterday. We've done more outlandish things than that. Sometimes we've done things like play during the intermission, just to get people to sort of take their minds off of, okay, now the concert's now it's not, and it's something else, and now it's the concert again. So the music, you get that feeling of flowing throughout. And of course, with myself, not so much with the Tosche Group, I've tried to do improvisations and tributes to American composers in the jazz field when I've felt that I was capable of it. Those things help, I guess. Chamber music is going to always be a matter of trying to find the audiences, because they're out there. It's just that it's not a mass kind of music. You need to have an intimacy. You can't do chamber music in Madison Square Garden, and it loses something when it becomes part of a sort of video scene or the mass market. People need to. They don't. It's not that you have to be so overly educated or do a super amount of homework in order to enjoy a concert. But I think you when you come into a chamber music hall and sit down, there's a specialness about that experience that you can't describe to somebody unless they actually get there. So advertising about it and all those things, it doesn't, I don't know, that's not, it's just experiencing it yourself.
My guest is clarinetist Richard Stoltzman, who's in Philadelphia to perform this evening with the Philly Pops, and they'll be performing at the Academy of Music this evening. I thought we'd take a pause for a moment from our interview and listen to to some of your music. And why don't we hear a selection from the album that you won the Grammy for a couple of years ago?
Fine.
And this is an album of Brahms sonatas. And we'll hear, let's see, what have I chosen here? We'll we'll hear the first movement of Brahms Sonata in F minor, Opus 120. This is the Allegro. And performing is Richard Stoltzman on clarinet, Richard Good piano.
Thank you.
We heard Brahms' Sonata for Clarinet and Piano, Opus 120. We heard the first movement, and we heard Richard Stolzman on clarinet, Richard Good at the piano. Richard Stolzman is my guest. He'll be performing this evening with the Philly Pops at the Academy of Music. Have you had to work hard to build a large enough repertoire to sustain you as a soloist?
Not too hard. There's an awful lot of, I mean, there are many, many concertos for clarinet. I mean, Mozart is not the only person who wrote a clarinet concerto, and I find that I have about 15 or so works in my fingers, plus a repertoire list that's at least twice that many, and I can't, you know, that's plenty. I feel sorry sometimes for pianists who, they're probably, even if they, you know, live to be 100, they'll never get through all the repertoire there is for the piano. And they kind of sometimes become specialists, either a Beethoven specialist or a Bach specialist, Schubert specialist, Mozart specialist, or something like that. And as a clarinetist, you can call it the limit of the repertoire, but I call it sort of the fascination that of the repertoire, that you have to be a specialist in many different eras and many different kinds of music, and it's, for me, it's very rewarding.
You've transcribed a lot of pieces, some for instance from cello to clarinet,
arpeggionian.
Are there any taboos that you're not supposed to, you know, instruments you're not supposed to transcribe from?
No, I don't think so. I usually do it on recommendation from somebody else. Like the arpeggione came from Piatigorsky, who said, "Why don't you play this? You know, I'm so tired of hearing this piece on the cello. It sounds like a contest piece, and maybe it's going to be easier on the clarinet," which it was. It's very easy to play on the clarinet, or I mean, relatively. So that was one piece that I started off with. And I sometimes hear a work, and it sounds so beautiful, like some of the Schubert sonatines. They're so beautiful, and playing them on the clarinet doesn't seem to be wrong at all. It's just playing the music, the beautiful music. I love to do that. I just transcribed a divertimento of Stravinsky, which is originally actually by the composer for a, I believe, for orchestra, and then he transcribed it himself for violin and piano, and I just transcribed it for clarinet and piano.
You've been playing some jazz compositions in some of your clarinet performances. Do you think that jazz musicians and classical musicians have preconceptions of one another?
Probably, yeah. But I find when you actually meet a jazz musician face-to-face, or at least the ones I've met face-to-face, they are just like you. I mean, they're normal musicians. We all come from the same... First of all, I always say when I'm talking with students in master classes or whatever that you can count yourself to be so lucky if you can call yourself a musician, because you're probably in one of the few professions left where you're not in it for the money, mostly. You have to just figure the music's greater than you, and the main reason you're doing it is because it's like being in NPR or something like that. One of those few things where you don't do it for the money. And you just feel like as soon as somebody calls themselves a musician, you're already talking about a kind of proud group of people who are dedicating themselves to something that's bigger than them, which is the music. And so you can meet on that level right away. And working with people like Eddie Gomez, for instance, has just been only nurturing and rewarding and nothing else but...
I think that in some people's hands, sometimes when a classical performer plays a jazz piece, it risks being condescending, like, okay, now we're going to let down our hair and get informal and just swing. What do you do to kind of prevent that kind of attitude in a concert?
When I've done concerts with, say, with Bill Douglas, who is a multifaceted performer who plays both classical and jazz piano and also plays bassoon very well, too. One thing we've decided to do is not change our clothes. Sometimes people say, "Oh, you're going to do the second half of the concert. Well, you can come out, you know, take off your coats and stuff like that." Forget it. We wear whatever we wear because of that's the way we feel. for all music. And we choose composers that we think people ought to know about, like, say, it was a wonderful woman composer named Carla Bley that we do works of. And the masters, like Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk, sometimes we just play the melodies rather than, say, just go out and improvise. We'll just play these tunes because they need to be part of the public consciousness so that they become sort of standards like other music is. And I mean, sure, we have a good time. I have a good time playing Brahms. I have a good time playing Schubert and Mozart and Stravinsky. And my hair is just as far down when I'm playing Brahms as it is when I'm playing bebop.
How did you start playing clarinet? Was it an instrument assigned to you in class? Did you choose it yourself?
Well, just about. I found a clarinet on the floor in my dad's bedroom once. It was sort of underneath the bed, and I was rolling it around, you know, like a toy or something. And I think my dad found me and decided I had an interest in the clarinet. And he bought me rented a metal clarinet for me, so I couldn't break it. There was an itinerant teacher in the public schools who could teach you the fingerings on any instrument that you brought in. So I brought in the clarinet, and he taught me the fingerings on it. And that's sort of how I got started.
What did you want to play at the beginning?
Well, actually, I also had an alto sax that my dad had, and I got to play that a little bit. And I enjoyed the alto sax because of the beauty of the sound, I guess. And also, you didn't have to worry about your fingers trying to cover the holes like you do on the clarinet. The clarinet stayed with me. And I was also playing the sax, but I found that in order to really get the kind of discipline and quality that I wanted out of a clarinet, I had to forego playing the other instruments. So clarinet became my love.
One of my still favorite comments about clarinet compared to saxophone was made by a jazz saxophonist named Teddy Edwards, who played both when he was young and mm-hmm. gave up the clarinet for saxophone. And I said, well, why'd you give it up? And he said, the clarinet is like a vampire. It sucks your blood.
I don't think so. Well, I mean, you have to give it a lot of attention, but no, it's not a vampire.
Did you ever wish that you had an easier instrument that you'd chosen?
Oh, clarinet's easy.
You think it's easy?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. In fact, one of my teachers said, look, if it's not easy, do something else. He was slightly cynical that way, but it was a good teacher, Kalman Opperman. I remember him saying, well, if it's not easy for you now, forget it. So I really think it's got its problems, but I love it.
Did you ever play in a school band?
Sure.
The clarinet, I think, is always the most the most trying section to listen to in a school band, except because they squeak all the time.
Right. Well, squeaking. That's why people don't go to clarinet recitals. I mean, and that's why people come back and say, "Gee, I didn't think the clarinet sounded like," because they have this idea of what the clarinet. And you just said it right there, squeaking. You know, all these. Extraneous sort of street sounds instead of the actual music. It's true, but come to a clarinet concert and find out for yourself, folks.
Did you have strict teachers when you were young who were very, very demanding?
I was very blessed with always understanding teachers. Some of them at times were very demanding, and that was good for me at certain times. Other times in my life, they were lenient, and that was also good. I had the right kind of teachers at the right times. I think that was very important.
When you're very serious about your music when you're still a kid or you know, 14, you have to make a lot of similar decisions that an adult makes about their career. You know, how much time do you want left for your family and friends and personal life and leisure, and how much you're going to devote to your career or your work or whatever? And when you're 14, you're playing seriously. You have to think about that at such a young age. Did you go through that?
No. I didn't have this great pie in the sky idea of a career. There wasn't anybody for me to emulate in that sense anyway. I didn't look to somebody as a role model and say, I want to be like this clarinet player who goes around the world playing concertos. There wasn't anybody doing that. So I settled on enjoying the instrument, and I liked the fact that when I played it, people enjoyed listening. And I pursued an education not just in music, but I found always that the most satisfying moments of my life were with music and being with musicians, and so that kind of just held me in its grasp, in its sort of gravity.
What did you think you were going to do when you were old enough to have to get out there and work?
I never knew. I still don't know what I'm going to do. I never feel like I've got a job. I always feel like I'm really not doing work. And it's a great feeling, but I didn't have a 9-to-5, and I sometimes wake up in the morning and think, is this really, I better get out there and start doing something for a living pretty soon, you know? I'm, after all, got a family and everything. I'm being a little facetious, but there is that feeling that I just never said, okay, now these are my career goals and this is what I want to achieve. I remember once I heard Keith Wilson, my clarinet teacher at Yale, play the Brahms Clarinet Quintet. I'd never even heard it. I was already in graduate school and I'd never even heard the Brahms Clarinet Quintet. And I heard that and I thought, oh my God, is this music for the clarinet? I can't believe it's so wonderful. And I was very moved and I thought, if I can only play this once before I die, I will be, satisfied. Little did I know that I was going to be playing it many, many times and with countless different groups and so on. But so in that, sort of that feeling of kind of, it's all been sort of gravy, it's great. And I didn't have any huge aspirations. And so maybe I'm just lucky.
Didn't you play jazz before playing classical music when you were young?
Sure, yeah. I started off with my dad when he was in church. He was the director of a Sunday school orchestra, and I used to play, not jazz, but I used to fill in the chords with my instrument in the hymn tunes. And then he bought me some Music Minus One records, so I could learn to do that kind of improvising.
What got you over to classical music?
Well, I think my earliest teachers felt... the one I had in San Francisco played both jazz and classical music. And in fact, the first piece I played on a recital, my classical piece, I think it was in fifth grade, was Rimsky-Korsakov's Hymn to the Sun. And my other piece was Hoagy Carmichael's Smoke Gets in Your Eyes? No.
Is it Johnny Mercer?
Yeah. No, what's it? Because Hoagy Carmichael. Stardust.
Stardust, yeah.
So... those, I started off my entire, whatever you want to call career in the fifth grade playing to a classical composer and an American sort of jazz composer. And I guess it just went on from there. When I was in high school, one of my clarinet teachers, Jimmy Wilbur, he played at the radio station in Cincinnati, played jazz, and then he also doubled in the orchestra. And It was that way until I really got into the upper echelons of clarinet study, where then the masters of the clarinet were strictly classical-based musicians, and then I found my jazz outlets outside of clarinet study.
When you were studying with the masters of the clarinet, did each mm-hmm. one of those masters try to change your embouchure and mm-hmm. change something about your fingering to fit what they thought was the mm-hmm. best technique?
Yep.
Did that drive you crazy?
Well,
every time you reach this plateau, it's like someone says, no, change it.
Well, it's humiliating and it's humbling, but it's good for you. And I think you have to put yourself in the mind of a beginner each time you start with a teacher and say, okay, I know a lot, but I'm just going to say I don't know it. And you have to let go of the idea that you're superior or that you've really got it together and yield yourself to the master teacher. Now, not everybody should do that or could do that, and not all the teachers are really the ones you want to give up everything for. But in my instant cases, I've had people who've taken care to give me the right training. I think to be a teacher is the greatest calling. It's much more difficult than being a performer.
Do you teach much?
No, that's why I said it's too hard. It's tremendously difficult to be a teacher. You have to give. I mean, what happens if you're tremendously disciplined and you give this, great lesson to a teacher? You don't get an audience standing up, say bravo, bravo, or clapping. Nothing, You just sometimes, in fact, the student hates you for many years until they finally realize that what you said was wise, It's a terrible profession. It's very, very, very demanding.
Are there any stories behind your own instrument, the clarinet that you play on now?
No. Clarinet is a, you know, I think of my wife, Lucy, who has sort of an inexpensive violin. I don't know, probably costs about $80,000, one of the cheap ones, you know. I mean, clarinet, it's probably the last of the sort of disposable instruments. You use it for a while and you throw it away.
I think in some ways clarinetists are among the more neurotic of musicians because of reeds. Because you could just drive yourself crazy finding a good reed.
Yeah, you can, but oboe players are more. That's what my wife said, because she used to go out with oboe players and bassoon players before she went out. Well, you know, she went out with clarinet players too. But anyway, she decided on that she would probably, if she was going to marry, she'd marry a clarinet. She was entranced by wind players, that's what she tells me anyway. But she decided the least neurotic was the clarinet players. First of all, a single reed instead of a double reed, and you could buy them after all. So she decided to go with the lesser of evils there.
How crazy are you about reeds? Will you spend days whittling them down and making them yourself?
I studied making reeds, and I find it's a very important thing to know. But to tell you the truth, I just go out and buy bunches of reeds that are made by machines and not well made, and go through tons of them until I find one that works, and then I play it. And it's real simple-minded, but if I start getting hung up on the great reed, you know, it's never going to happen. Plus, I'm in a different climate and a different humidity and a different environment, different altitude practically every day. And if I finally say, oh, I finally got the great reed, and then on the next day I'm in Denver, or the next day I'm in Salt Lake or whatever, you know, it's not good.
What do you do when you have a lousy reed at a recital?
Well, I always have a bunch of reeds in my pocket. I put at least three extra reeds in my pocket, and I figure, okay, if this one doesn't work, on to the next one. So that's what I do about that.
You've been performing as a soloist for several years now, but now you have two children.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make it especially hard to be traveling all the time?
Sure, I miss them a lot, and I can talk with Lucy, my wife, on the phone, but I don't talk too much with the children, and they, you know, it's great to come back home to them, of course, but it's a kind of a strange situation. I used to tour with my son for a little bit when he was 3 and 4, and I would take him on the road. It was great fun. But now he's in school, so can't do that. But luckily, or at least they seem to be very unusual persons, Peter, John, and Margaret Ann, and they are very loving and seem to be willing to understand what I'm doing. I just hope that I can participate in their lives to a stronger degree. Maybe I will, as Lucy does more touring. I told you earlier, she's joining a string quartet, Muir String Quartet. She'll be the first violinist in that. We're moving to Boston, and she's going to be doing a great deal of touring. Maybe I'll just cut back and be more of a house husband.
Well, what are your choices if you have, if both of you are touring? It's probably next to impossible to really work out a perfectly compatible schedule.
Yeah, especially work with the Muir Quartet just came up recently, and so my managers worked out my whole schedule from the West Coast, and now all of a sudden we're moving to Boston. So I don't know. It's going to be scary. I'm worried about it, and we need to find somebody who is a fantastic person to live with us, who would be willing to, you know, be responsible for our children and give them the kind of care that we want. And I've thought about taking Peter John with me, just traveling and trying to, you know, get his education on the side, so to speak. But I don't know. Everyone needs to have their own peers to be with and their own friends. And it's a little selfish of me to say, okay, I'll just take my son, you know, and he can be my companion. I know that it's very important for him to have his own society to be able to relate to, and I don't have any answers.
As you mentioned, your wife Lucy is a violinist.
Mm-hmm.
Do you play together much?
No, we hardly ever play together. And in fact, unfortunately, we had just decided to do some more playing together the month before this offer came up from the Muir Quartet. She and I and Richard Good were forming a trio to play concerts. And it was one of the saddest things for her was to have to say that she couldn't do that because, of course, the quartet's a full-time thing. So we had to cancel those engagements. And it may be just as well that we don't play together because then we can discuss the frustrations and the and also the great moments of our performances away from each other.
Yeah, you know, people, too, I think, are sometimes more impatient mm-hmm. with their spouses than they are with other people when it comes to working together.
Yeah, I think you expect them to understand more readily. And also, there are things that are so personal in music that bringing them out in the open and sort of trashing them around and trying to deal with it is just too painful.
You had mentioned before that you've never been the kind of person to have like goals in mind and a whole future mapped out.
Right.
But what's on your agenda for the near future?
The near future? Let's see. Well, I have to get something to eat before I go to the concert. No, but I guess
it's near enough.
Yeah. The goals are the agenda is. Next week I'm going to Vienna to start a tour with the Vienna Chamber Orchestra with Philippe Entremont. I have to get back to my home before then to see my kids and find my tails because Philippe Entremont said I have to wear tails. And then I'm going to play with the Radio Orchestra in Milan and meet with the Lebec sisters, Katia and Maria Lebec, a duo piano team, to work out some repertoire with them in France. And then I go to London to premiere a concerto by Donald Erb and back to Louisville, Kentucky, to do a concerto of Corleano's and so on and so on.
Where do you practice when you're on the road all the time?
I do it in the hotel rooms. I turn up the television very loud, and people usually don't complain. If I play without the television, people complain right away. But somehow, loud television is okay. It's okay.
We have about 2 minutes left. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about clothes in that time. Am I wrong? Didn't you once wear sneakers for
That's
a
right.
recital?
Sneakers, T-shirts, jeans, yeah. That was an attempt to get people to put aside preconceived notions about how a classical musician ought to look in order for them to play classical music. Then it got to the point where people expected me to wear tennis shoes and were sort of upset if I didn't come out looking like a bum. So I finally sort of compromised, and I have various kinds of shoes and pants and shirts and everything. And I don't worry about it too much anymore. The main thing is to play well.
But so you can choose what you wear. What about if you're a soloist with an orchestra? Do
well, like
they
I said,
let you know?
They let you know. Sometimes they say, "Oh, you're the soloist. Wear whatever you want." And then sometimes, as with Entremont, when I said, "Well, I have a lovely black velvet tuxedo. I could wear that," and I just heard him on the phone from Vienna saying, "No, I don't think so. We wear tails here in Vienna, you know." And oops, okay. But I mean, he was right. The wearing of certain kinds of clothes, you have to get that away so that people can just listen to the music. And if it upsets people to see you in a tuxedo, so forget it. Who cares? You know, I don't care what I wear as long as people like and enjoy and listen to the music.
Do you think people dress differently when they know that you can be flippant about your own clothes?
You mean for the concert? People
yeah,
come
audiences.
To the concert?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know why people get... I think the best thing to do is feel comfortable. If you're going to a concert hall, you want to sit, relax, open yourself up, and listen. And whatever attire fits that is the best.
Well, it's really been fun to have you here. Thank you very much for
sure.
talking with us today.
Sure, thank you.
And my guest has been clarinetist Richard Stoltzman, who is one of the premier clarinet soloists in America. He's traveled around the world playing with symphony orchestras and on recital tours. He records for RCA Red Seal and also was a founding member of the chamber ensemble Tashi. He'll be performing in Philadelphia this evening with the Philly Pops in a concert that begins at 8 o'clock tonight at the Academy of Music. Why don't I ask you what's going to be on the menu for this evening?
Well, on the menu tonight is Rossini, Introduction, Theme, and Variations for Clarinet and Orchestra. a premiere of a new work by Duke by Claire Fisher on Duke Ellington Suite themes, and then whatever Peter Nero throws out to improvise, we'll just do some tunes, probably some Charlie Parker and maybe a little more Ellington and whatever comes to mind.
Okay, well, thank you, Richard Stelzman, for being here.